the first episode of Founder Chats. I'm your host, Josh Pigford, founder of Bearmetrics. Each week, we will talk to a different founder about how they're growing their business, what's working, what's not working, what they're struggling with. The idea here is that imagine like me and another founder are grabbing coffee and you get to overhear the conversation. So these are honest conversations. There's no script. It's just, hey, let's talk shop and then we'll see what happens. In this first episode, I talk to David Cancel. He's the founder of Drift, previously was at HubSpot and a bunch of other startups. It's a great conversation. We jump right in to the juicy stuff. I hope you enjoy it.
Yo, dude.
Hey, man. How's it going?
Damn, man. Your beard is serious. I have some envy. Mine is short.
Well, if you work hard when you grow up, you can have a beard like mine.
That's awesome.
Well, cool, man. Well, I appreciate you doing this. The format for us.
Same here, man.
Well, like on for the podcast for me, it's always been basically an audio version of our articles that I've been writing.
Oh, cool. I love it.
Which works great, but having somebody else on the call will be good.
Did you start out that way, like using that method because you were transcribing the articles? Is that how it started?
I wasn't. I just started off, I'd write the article, and then lots of people have been like, man, I would love to listen to a version of this because, you know, people are in commutes and things like that. So I started just recording them after the fact and it's worked pretty well. Mm-hmm. So it's another format, I guess, to distribute it in. So it works pretty well.
Yeah. It's a totally different thing.
I guess it's a little,
that's awesome.
Little extra life out of a given piece of content.
Exactly. A lot more reuse. How you been, man?
I've been good.
I think the last time we spoke was Pop Signals. Is that right?
Pop Survey. Yeah. So that with, David Hauser and, CMAC from Grasshopper. So they're co-founders on that.
Yep.
That's ultimately what I built Bearmetrics for. Stuck with Bearmetrics after that. So
that's fine. And how's Bearmetrics been going? I've been watching you from the sidelines.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. We it's been interesting. Like I had never taken funding before. And that's been a different ball game. Sure.
I like how you said that.
I don't know. I have very different feelings of, I'm not anti-VC money, but...
Yeah, it's just a different game.
It is, and what I would use it for, I think, is different. Like,
yeah.
I used too much of it for hiring, and now we've put ourselves in a tough spot.
Yeah.
So the Buffer guys had just written about how they had to, you know, lay off like 10 people.
Yeah.
And like the week that they published that was, we were in the same situation, and I didn't have to lay anybody off, but like everybody had to take... I had to ask everybody to take like a 15% pay cut. I took a 30% pay cut, having to hunker down to get profitable.
This is what you're talking about here. This is the shit no one wants to talk about.
It is, right? And like,
yep. Nobody. I've been through, you know, I've done it every which way, mostly venture funded.
Yep.
But I've done it bootstrapped. I've done it angel. And it's just different games, right? It's different parameters. Yep. And as long as you know that going in, I don't think one's necessarily better than the other. So yep. I'm not religious on it.
Yep.
But, you know, I like talking about this stuff. That's why I always like reference back Ben's, you know, hard thing about hard things. Because, you know, after having gone through this and you're going through it, like that was the only book that ever felt like this is what it feels like.
Right.
There's no other business book felt that way.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, and that was like the impetus for like Bearmetrics, you know, making like us making all our metrics public. And then like, and that's a lot of the reason that Buffer did that too, is to keep the conversation, you know, kind of honest, at least as much as possible. Because nobody talks about it, right? Like,
no,
you just post the rosy sugar coated junk.
Yeah. The like, oh, we're going on a field trip or vacation or t-shirts.
Right.
Or whatever.
Right. It's the mm-hmm. whole, like, you know, people get on Facebook and you just see like all the perfect moments of everybody's lives and not the nasty stuff that where everybody's like depressed.
Are you guys all virtual?
Yeah, we are. So I'm in Alabama and, we've got like four guys in the U.S. and then four guys outside of the U.S. and the U.K. and Canada.
It's great that you didn't. I mean, it must have been hard with your team and yourself on the pay cut, but you didn't have to lay anyone off, which is you know, even tougher.
Right. Well, I was trying. It was like either everybody takes a pay cut or we've got to lay off a couple of people. And mm-hmm. the pay cut seemed like it would hurt morale a lot less than layoffs.
For sure.
So
yeah, my first company. I don't know if we started the podcast.
I can do a little intro after the fact, and then we're good.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, one of my first startups, Compete. Like, we started in 2000, raised funding, and then started the company already after the .com explosion meltdown. And then in the first 2 years, had a layoff, two rounds of layoff. And I'm telling you, nothing has shaped me more than going through that.
Yep.
So painful, right? And both in a good and bad way, right? Maybe you can argue that it's made me more conservative than I should be, but like, it was just so painful to go through that process. It was nuts. I don't wish it on anyone.
And I mean, I feel like it's, you hate to do that to people, but it's, I mean, our team took it really, really well. Like, nobody on our team's like dramatic or anything. Like, I wasn't like expecting anybody to really blow up. But I mean, everybody was like, it almost like instilled this sort of like, all right, well then like, let's hunker down and do this. Versus like, I feel like if we had to lay people off, the byproduct would have been like, oh gosh, I hope I'm not next.
That's exactly what happened.
Right. Yep. And so far it's been a net positive, both morale and, cash.
Yeah. And cash wise too. Yeah. And so what is your focus now? Like, what is keeping you up at night?
So really it's like figuring out how to grow revenue. Like, and that trickles down to a lot of different ways, but I mean, that's sort of like the hole in the ship right now that needs to be plugged, is really, it's revenue growth specifically. So I spent a lot of time, like, so when Baremetrics launched, we were just Stripe, just for Stripe. And then, almost a month ago, expanded to Recurly and Braintree. And so we spent a bunch of time, trying to get basically make the target market larger.
Yeah.
So that it's not so.
I didn't know you guys were using Recurly. You weren't when I looked at you a while back. So, or that you integrated into it, I should say.
Yep.
So to take a look. We're Recurly users.
Oh, nice. Cool. Yeah. It should work. Recurly's probably been one of the least hassles from like an integration standpoint, because basically Recurly is a subscription platform, right? Like,
yes.
So whereas like Stripe and Braintree have a subscription sort of component, but the majority of people actually are not subscription companies that are on those.
And how has it been like building a business on top of Stripe specifically?
So they're, early on, it was sort of scratching my own itch, so I just kind of went with that. But they're, from an API standpoint, they're by far the easiest. And then from like a partnership standpoint, like early on, they're fantastic. Like when I first built Baremetrics, like Stripe as a company was only like, I think 80 people or something. And they're like four or five times that now. So I had a pretty close, like relationship with them, would talk frequently. They were sort of like, hey, how can we help? They would, if you emailed Stripe and were like, hey, how can we get more analytics? Like, they'd suggest Baremetrics. So it was a good partnership for sure.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah. I'm always amazed, I don't know the Stripe people, and I love their product, but I'm always amazed every time I like dive back into Stripe for whatever reason, both positively and just surprised, I guess. Because great on the API stuff, obviously, right? Developer focus. But I'm always expecting it to do things that it doesn't do.
Yes.
Right? I'm just like, really?
It doesn't do that?
Yeah. 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 Or it does it, but you still have to write all the other code to do that? Interesting. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because it's like, you think of, I know Recurly, and there's a couple other products that have like things like credit card forms that are just like, you get up and running within minutes, where like, Stripe is so developer focused that, there's been so many things that have been built on top of Stripe to basically make it as accessible to non-developers as, say, Recurly or like a Chargeify or something are.
Yeah. And so I'm always, one of the most amazing parts about it to me is just, and maybe you'll resonate with this having started a company, is how do you maintain that level of focus, right? And not build those other things. Like that part is actually the most amazing part of Stripe to me.
Yep. Well, the fact that they're, 300-400 people now and are still, for the most part, so hyper-focused on the thing that they're doing.
Yeah, I want that. I want that DNA. Right. I'm like, how do you do that? How do you turn down revenue opportunity after revenue?
For sure. And not, you know, it's like, it's so hard to not just like, ooh, shiny object. This one thing I actually want to talk about was like, sort of founder optimism.
I suffer from it.
Right. Me too. Right. So the idea of like this idea that you've got, or, that thing would have some massive payoff, like thinking that everything's got a massive payoff when it doesn't.
It almost never
right. Happens. Yeah. In fact, it's the opposite. It's like, chances are this will not work out at all. And so I'm curious, like, how you, I don't know about battle founder optimism, but sort of keep yourself in check and not chase all the shiny things. In the case of like our cash flow issues, that was the result of over optimism on my part for growth, you know?
Yes.
So like, how do you avoid that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I'd say like I do and I don't. So I think I do avoid it, right? And I'll talk about like how. But all of us, I think, just have to battle with it and succumb to it every once in a while. So I am, you know, a victim of optimism, founder optimism as much as anyone else. The way that what I've used to kind of battle it over time, and this just come from looking at myself over the years, is defaulting to the customer is my number one thing, right? And because so many times you're building, like you did with Barometrics, like building stuff to scratch your own itch, and it's like you're the first customer, party of one, right? And so like you don't have to convince anyone else, it's for yourself, there's no people involved. And the second that I find that people are involved, then things get really complicated. And whether that, or if it's, you know, selling to customers, every new customer, every new person you add to the team, things get complicated.
Yep. Do you find that that the team itself, while it adds complexity, also helps with the balance?
It can. It depends on the team. I think definitely it does. You know, so having more than yourself helps to balance things out because there are going to be alternate voices. Sometimes, depending on how strong your voice is amongst those voices, maybe you can drown them out, or depending on your optimism and your ability to convince others of your optimism, right? Sure. Sometimes you can drown that out. But I think net, it definitely helps. And I love, for me, starting companies is all about people. You know, I kind of went through this process myself of being like solo founder, scratch my own itch, you know, early on to like, and thinking that was really hard going through that. And it was, not to discount it, but the people stuff was way harder. And so from like a learning standpoint, that's the part that I geek out the most on. And I always say that it's like 99% people at this point, and software and everything else is a small piece of the pie.
Yeah. And that's been interesting for me because I've been basically solo founder for a decade. And so, you know, now that I've built this team around Barometrics, like I find that I'm almost like playing psychologist, or like not about therapist, but I mean, you know, like I spend all my time like trying to figure out how the humans play into this, right?
Oh, it's so funny that you said that. That's exactly what I say all the time. It's like, you know, I'm part psychologist and part kind of like cruise ship director.
Right. Like twiddling with all the knobs and then seeing how people react to that, both customers and your team.
Exactly. Like, are these like within your team, like, are these people going to work well together? How come they're not working well together? Like, what's different about their personalities? Like, should these people work together or these two over here work together? It's amazing. I spent so much time, you know, before starting Drift at HubSpot, where I ran product and engineering and that stuff. There we were really going to scale. So for me, it was my largest team ever. It was, you know, almost 200 people. And so a lot of hiring, a lot of growth, and spent a lot of time there, you know, really figuring out the psychologist part.
Yep. And that stuff's super interesting to me. I actually like was briefly a psychology major in college. So like, it's funny, you know, like college stuff. Like to me, the stuff like if you had a degree in psychology or something, almost seems way more valuable than like having a business degree.
I totally agree with you. Yeah. If there was only one thing I could go and actually spend time now reading books that would fall in the psychology category more than anything else. And, you know, like I geek out on things like I ever had to take a personality test many years ago or that I, you know, we did at one of my companies. I was like, this is the dumbest thing ever. And then I was the last person literally in my own company to take it. And I hated it. And I took it and I was like, oh, man. And since then, I've kind of been a total proponent of it.
Well, I did, like, probably a month ago, I did the Strengths Finder.
Oh, yeah.
And that was fantastic, like, super insightful. My wife had been like, you should do this. I'm going to do it. And then we can, like, compare. I'm like, fine. Yeah. And I did it. And I was like, and then I spent the next, like, week just, like, diving into all the things.
Oh, that's crazy. You should do the other ones, too, if you haven't. Like, MBTI, if you go to 16personalities.com.
Oh, nice.
It's just it's a free website, totally free. We use it internally. And everyone, even when we interview people, if they don't know their type, we ask them to take it. That's Myers-Briggs, right? That's just one type. And then we used to use DISC, which is another type. But, you know, they're all different. And, you know, for me, it's like personality types are a starting point that you can start to understand how to communicate to someone.
Yep, I totally agree. So,
has it helped your marriage?
Well, I mean, it's been interesting. Yes. So,
that's great.
You know, my wife and I have done personality stuff like early on. So, I've been married 11 years. And you know, early on, we did lots of like premarital counseling. We've done like marriage counseling, all that stuff. And so, yes, we've done a lot of the sort of personality tests and trying to figure out like how all that stuff plays into how we communicate and all. So yeah, it's all good stuff.
That is awesome.
Yeah. So you touched on a few things here. So Compete and HubSpot and then the thing that you're currently working on at Drift. So you had a few other companies as well, like between Compete and HubSpot. Like, so what can we talk a little bit about those few companies?
Sure. Yeah, and there's companies before Compete. So,
okay, so there you go. That up,
what do you talk about?
Yeah.
So for, you know, Compete was a company I started in 2000, and we got acquired in 2006, 2007, around that time, 2007. And I left at that point, and most of the team, actually the entire team, stayed there as part of the acquirer, and I left and didn't know what I would do next. And I ended up starting a company called Lookery. And I started that with a friend of mine who I had never worked with, but he lived out in the West Coast, and I was based in Boston, and we kind of like started this company almost accidentally, right? We were just working on a project, and it was at the time, so it was 2007, and in the summer of 2007, Facebook had just launched a platform, right? So the Facebook platform just opened at that point. And so it was like this rush, if you can remember, like early Mafia Wars and all that kind of stuff. Like of all of these apps, and in the beginning, it wasn't just games. It was all sorts of apps that were built inside the Facebook ecosystem. It happened to be that a lot of our friends were building apps on those systems, and some of them still have companies in that ecosystem. And one of the problems that they had was that there was no way to make money in it on the system. And so we started to figure out, like, can we help them make money? So how to help them monetize in there. And so we ended up building, like, this total ghetto at the time ad network for social media apps, right? And so it was focused on social media apps. That was Lookery. It was a total accidental the way it started. And it got us working with what later became Zynga and Noah Kagan. If you know him, he had a whole bunch of apps in the ecosystem. I mean, he had a huge portfolio of apps back then. And a lot of other people that I can mention that you would know had apps and experiments going on in that system. We learned a lot, right? Like a lot of stuff that I look back at now, like that people would say, you know, growth hacking or whatever you want to call it. Like these were the early, early days. And we were seeing a lot of that stuff happening in that ecosystem. Yep. Anyway, we built this company. We started it. We got some angel money for it. We ultimately sold the ad network piece to another company. And then at that time, we were like, let's focus the company on helping other ad networks use this kind of social data, right? So it was not personal data. It wasn't David Cancel or Josh. It was just like attribute data, like likes movies, likes this, likes that, you know, all kinds of data around about users. But at the time, it was so early that most ad networks didn't know what an API was. So we were basically an API business, didn't have developers to integrate, right? They were mostly salespeople. And it was like this case of being too early, too soon, which is common in the startup world. And we ultimately shut that company down, right, at that point.
Gotcha. So what there's a performable was that?
Yeah, and so there was something in between. So like I left Looker. It was still going at the time. My partner, who was CEO, didn't shut it down at that point. He was still had it going. I took some time off just over the summer, and I started working on this browser plugin called Ghostery.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, so like I created this thing which I thought nobody in the world would ever care about, basically because I wanted to know what other ad networks and anything else was running, you know, on a website. So you'd visit, you'd install Ghostery, at the time only Firefox. You'd visit a website, and then it would tell you, hey, it's running Drift and HubSpot and this ad network and Facebook Pixel and all these kind of things. And I thought, like, who in the world is so geeky? So I only released it to myself, and then a couple friends out in the Bay Area saw it and asked me to release it publicly so that they could use it, and they were equally as geeky, so I did. And then all of a sudden, you know, within less than a year, I had 3 million people using Ghostery.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, all through Firefox, right, and then early Chrome extension.
Yeah.
And it sounds crazy now, so, like, but it was, like, the whole time I was like, this isn't a business, right? Like, this is just, like, a plug-in. At the time, Firefox and even Chrome were vehemently against extension developers because of the open source kind of nature of things to make any money. So I was like, you couldn't monetize anything in that ecosystem. And so I was like, can't make money doing this thing, but it's fun and I like it. And then I was getting ready to start my next company called Performable. And a few people approached me to buy the company. I sold Ghostery to a company in New York that got started. And Ghostery continues now. They have 300 million users using Ghostery. And it's insane. Yeah, it's nuts. And, you know, if you go to like an ad network or web analytics kind of like conference or something like that, I'll walk around and see people with Ghostery stickers at this point. So it's nuts.
Yeah. That's funny. So then you went on to Performable, which is what ultimately is what HubSpot acquired?
Yeah, so I started this company, Performable, with one of my my VP of engineering back at Lookery, who was then became my CTO, Elias Torres, who's mm-hmm. my co-founder at Drift. And so we started Performable, and I said what Performable was an early marketing automation company, yep. right? And our competitors at the time would have been companies like Mixpanel and Kissmetrics yep. and a couple, you know, although we were selling and mostly focused from a company standpoint against Omniture, mm-hmm. which was acquired by Adobe at that point. So we were more enterprise instead of startup-y. So we started this company, and 18 months later, you know, HubSpot acquired us. And the history was that they had been trying to acquire us, you know, number of times throughout the first year. We said no, and then finally we agreed to do the acquisition. We said, like, you know, let's bring the companies together, and like we have the same mission, we knew each, you know, I knew Dharmesh and Brian and all the people who started HubSpot and all of their investors early on, and so we were all friends, and we wanted the same thing, which was like, can we build a massive company in Boston? Can we build something that ultimately, you know, will stand the test of time and be a pillar company here? And so, like, we're both trying to do the same thing. Let's see if we can do it together. They had an amazing marketing and sales machine, and we thought we were really strong from a product engineering standpoint. And so together, maybe we could create something awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And then how long were you at HubSpot?
And I came in as chief product officer. I ran engineering, design, product. Basically all that kind of stuff, which is unusual, right? Usually you have like a head of engineering and then a head of product, and those things are separate. Yep. I had a head of engineering and heads of product, but like we rolled it all under what we call product.
Gotcha. And then you left before the IPO, is that right?
Yeah, Elias and I left technically a couple, you know, 1 or 2 weeks, I don't remember, you know, before the IPO.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, gotcha. So with my investigative hat on, I mm-hmm. noticed that between Compete, which you were like hacking on for 7 years, which is a pretty long time,
yeah.
and you know,
really long time, right?
And then between that and then your time at HubSpot, like all the stuff in between, you were basically doing those things for like 12 to 24 months.
Yeah,
and you moved on. So I guess I'm curious, and like looking at Drift, that's basically yeah. where you're at now. Is that like mm-hmm. almost 2 year mark? So,
yes.
So do you feel like not that to like imply that you're going to bail on Drift or that it's going to get acquired or anything, but I guess I'm curious, like, is that an attention span thing or just sort of like, that's just sort of complete chance that's how that stuff played out?
Yeah, good question. This is a perfect psychology question, right? And maybe I don't even know the real answer myself.
Sure.
So here's my interpretation. I think for me, the way that I look at starting companies has always been around, it has been less about starting the company. It has been more about learning, right? So I have this kind of like obsession with learning in all aspects, not only business and starting companies, but in developing things, in life, and reading, whatever, all areas. So I always want to, I'm obsessed with growing. And when I look back at the companies that I started, they all started because I was obsessed with some idea or problem. And then when I left, kind of overlapped with when we sold the companies, overlapped with when I felt like the learning had stopped, right? And we can all relate to that. So like, for whatever reason, learning had stopped. I'd compete was my longest. That was 7 years, as you said. I started in 2000. The first 2 years were brutal, brutally hard. First almost 3 years were brutally hard. Like the meltdown was hard, but then like right after the meltdown was, we got going in the first year, and then September 11th happened. And so then we lost all our customers in September 11th because they were largely telecom and travel and media companies. And so none of them were buying. It was all shut down. So then it got really hard. And then, you know, it's all timing. And then the last 4 years of compete were kind of like the hockey stick. So if I would start to compete in 2004, it would have been like pure hockey stick, right? But we, you know, you can't control the macro. And the time we sold the company, I felt like personally, like I was getting to a point where all the learning had stopped, or the learning that I wanted to get to had stopped. We were about 150 people at that point. Largest company I had ever been a part of, really. Definitely my largest owned company. And so we sold the company. It ultimately turned out to be great because 2008, if you can remember, there was a meltdown, right? And so it was like perfect timing. It was great. And all of our investors, employees, and everyone were super happy that we did. And so that was great. We sold the company. And then the next couple of then it was Lookery. And Lookery was, for me, it was a company, but it was less of a company and more like a hack that kind of turned into a company, if that makes sense. I really didn't go into Lookery, in other words, saying, I'm going to start a company. And same thing with Ghostery. It was just a project.
Yep.
And then Performal was, I want to start a company. And it was painful to sell Performal to HubSpot at the time, although I look back now and it was like the best thing ever for lots of different reasons. It was painful because we didn't have one blip in those 18 months. It was like we had tons of customers. We had raised $3 million to start the company. By the time we acquired, we had, you know, 2/3 of that money still in the bank, right? It wasn't like we needed money. And we had lots of investors, including our own investor, trying to put more money in the company. And we had happy customers and we had lots of momentum. But I felt like if we could put the companies together, that we could create something bigger. And so that one was kind of like a reluctant, at the time, again, now I look back and think like it was the best thing ever, but it was kind of a reluctant decision and why it took multiple attempts before I finally said, you know, let's do it. And then cut to HubSpot. I was there about 3.5 years and then started Drift. And when I left HubSpot, I didn't know that we were going to start Drift. I didn't know what I was going to do exactly, but I knew like that the learning that I wanted to see had stopped at HubSpot. Not that HubSpot's tremendous and amazing and there's still learning happening there, but I wanted to see what would happen from 200 employees to 1,000 employees, rapid growth, right? Yeah. That was kind of like the timeline in my head, and that's exactly what I saw. We got to over 1,000 employees. When we were acquired by HubSpot, we were 200 employees, 2,000 customers, and we went to 1,000 employees, 15,000 customers.
Yeah.
And so I saw that, and I didn't want to learn the lessons of being a public company. I didn't want to learn the lessons, you know, that came after. I saw the thing that I wanted to see. And then when we left, and I didn't know if I'm going to start a company, am I going to retire, and what am I going to do, you know, I thought to myself, like, you know what? I still have something to prove. I still have one more in me, and I'm going to do it now. And if I'm going to bother to start another company at this point, that I'm going to go for it, whatever go for it means. Like, I'm going to go all out because this is it, right? I don't know if that's like, you know, I don't know how you read this psychologically, like this is some swan song or something, but like that I wasn't going to sell Drift and I'm not going to sell Drift. And we are going to go and try to build another, you know, large company or in Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry for the long answer.
No, that's perfect. That's perfect. So I guess, obviously, when you're like building anything from these sort of like small project, like, you know, what would be a browser plugin all the way up to HubSpot, which is like straight up at this point, almost certainly like enterprise software.
Yeah, definitely.
Whereas like Drift, I sort of pick up that it's probably not, at least at this point, not terribly focused on the enterprise side of things.
Correct.
What's your, like, this is almost certainly a personal preference thing, like small and medium-sized businesses versus enterprise from like a product standpoint, like do you, those are different types of problems to solve. And I'm curious for you, like what sort of, not pros and cons, but like, what do you find is fun about like each of those types of markets from like a product standpoint?
I like that question because there are things that are fun about them all.
Yeah.
And I kind of have like this, I don't know if it's contrarian, but I, you know, it feels like it when I tell people like this view on SMB and enterprise. And what I think is that SMB and enterprise are actually very similar to me from a product standpoint. And we can talk. We'll talk more about why. And I think what is actually abnormal and weird is the thing that we all, as especially in the SaaS world, focus on, which is this kind of middle of the market.
Yep.
And that's actually the weird from a product standpoint and psychology standpoint, that's the weird part of the market that we all think is kind of like normal, which is actually not normal. And what I mean by the middle of the market is, and what's weird about it is the middle of the market is highly technical, used to a lot of change, can do a lot of technical work and integrations and, you know, integrate Baremetrics into Drift and all this kind of stuff and, you know, is like hungry for change and hungry to do things on their own and try software and all that kind of stuff, right? That's the middle of the market. That's actually really weird. That's a weird part of the market. That's not, you know,
most businesses are not like that.
No, not at all. And so, but we all end up building software for that kind of user, which is not a normal user. And then I'd say the opposite ends of the spectrum, SMB and enterprise, are actually very similar in that they both resist change.
Yep.
For different reasons. They both need a lot of handholding and service work. SMB needs it because usually they don't have anyone on staff. You know, it might be an owner operator, it might be a very small team. They might not have a dedicated marketer or a dedicated admin or a developer or any of these things. So they need a lot of service work. And then on the enterprise side of things, they actually need a lot of service work too, but for other reasons, because there are so many people, because things are so complex, because they're dealing with so much compliance and they're so slow moving that a lot of the enterprise solution side of things is actually dealing with the humans and building services for the human, whether that's training, whether that's rollout of new releases, whether that's, you know, on-site integration, all of that kind of stuff. That's, they both need a lot of human touch, and we all build software for this weird anomaly that doesn't need any human touch.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it, to me, that's also, you know, like if you think of in terms of market size, mm-hmm. as well, like the I think the risk of that middle sort of market is it's like you end up, it's like startups serving startups.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a bad rut to get in.
Mm-hmm. I think you nailed it. I think it's a big risk of that market. And it is the market that we all as geeks, you know, like want to build for, and it's not normal. It's actually a small market that can cannibalize itself,
yep.
especially because those people are so into the new thing and trying, and, you know, loyalty is low. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're always looking for the latest and the greatest. On the opposite ends of the spectrum with SMB and enterprise, they're the opposite. They're looking for little change and not looking to switch things out easily. And so in some cases, that is the where the real money is, if you can figure that out. And you can see that, you know, for with apps that are now have transcended, you know, just building software into changing the way that we live, right? Whether that's, you know, something like Uber, right? Or, you know, insert other example here of things that are transforming day-to-day life. They're tapping into those opposite, those other ends of the spectrum of non-technical audiences, even though they started maybe techie.
Yep.
And you could see the market size impact that they have. Airbnb is another perfect example. It started off techie, but look at how it can be used by the entire market versus the stuff that we all do, including me. You know, I'm guilty, as just like everyone else, of building stuff for this weird niche in the middle.
Mm-hmm. And I think like there's, it's easy. Like if you're not, I would say most entrepreneurs are not necessarily, they're probably actually risk averse.
Yeah, definitely.
And it, to me, it seems like we need more entrepreneurs who are less risk averse and like really great at seeing the potential of things like outside of their own assumptions about like what they're doing. Right.
Yeah.
Cause you think like an Airbnb, like started off as this tiny little, just like weird idea that mm-hmm. they certainly would have never thought it would be what it is today.
Yes.
But like they had the sort of foresight, or like maybe they were less risk averse and said like, let's just see what happens if we keep going and going and going. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in some ways maybe they didn't give a shit, right? Like they didn't care at the time because they weren't believing their own hype at that point, because they started billions of dollars in hospitality revenue.
Yep, for sure.
No, I totally agree with you. I think, you know, one thing that I love your take on is, why do you think people have this misconception of that entrepreneurs are actually, you know, into risk?
I think, you know, to me, it comes. I feel like there's so many people who maybe they shouldn't be called entrepreneurs, but they're I don't know, makers. Like they're like, yes, they just build stuff, right? And for most people, especially like, I hesitate to say like older generations or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like that's kind of like atypical. Like technology seems so like voodoo to some people.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, if they make something, like I could never figure that out. Like they're, you know, like it's almost like this perception of an entrepreneur or like a tech person is like a magician. And
yeah,
so
this
view that they like, you know, they can create something out of nothing. So like, but that seems kind of risky. But like in reality, it's not risky at all. You're like,
it's not, you know, most people who start companies. Totally. Most people who start companies that I know are quite the opposite, right? They want more control, right? If not less control, they could probably be control freaks, you know?
Yes.
And so like, that's why they're starting a company and they want to control all the variables. So it's quite the opposite of what people think.
Well, I tell people like, I would be a terrible employee. Like,
yeah, me too.
The only job I ever had was, I lasted 7 weeks. And I quit and like, that's just, I have to like, not, it's, I don't even think it's a control thing. I think it's like a needing to have the freedom to like steer the ship in the way that I feel is most appropriate.
I love it because you're worse than me. You know, at least I did three and a half years almost at HubSpot. All right.
Oh, well, so I say that out, but my only real job was 7 weeks. I used to have a blog called the Apple blog, and GigaOm acquired it. This was probably 2007 or something like that. And so like I technically was employed there for a couple of years, but it was, interesting setup. But like I was still like building lots of other things at the time.
Got it.
I can't really be an employee. I'm bad news.
at least you know it.
Right. At least I can be upfront about that. So let's tackle one more thing. I don't want to take all your time here. So today I saw you tweeted about a competitor using, what was it, like an email?
Or messaging and positioning.
You're messaging, all that stuff, right. So I'm curious to your thoughts on like, or how you sort of approach or view competition, like how you let that mm-hmm. play or not play into how you're approaching building a company.
Yeah. So I love competition. So let's just say that from the beginning. I love it. I thrive on it. And actually today was like one of the most energetic days of Adrift ever for me. Right. I just love it. So I don't know why. I didn't know this about myself. You know, I wasn't big into sports or anything like that. So but in when it comes to building things, I'm very competitive. So I like it. That being said, like, I don't actually spend any time thinking about competitors when it comes to like how we build things. And I used to, you know, maybe in my first company, but, you know, I really switched over to this mode, which we mentioned before, of being like the customer is the thing that is right. And so I really focus in on just like, how do I solve customer problems? Like the customer doesn't care about competitors, even if they may mention a competitor. They really care about like solving their problem. And like, I'm here to solve customer problems. And so like, I obsess around customers and making them happy. And I don't really care about competitors. And I think especially competitors that are startups, you know, those are the ones that I care the least about, right? Because I'm like, and I wrote a post about this a long time ago while at Performable, that I had someone, which is common, you know, I was at some event, someone came up and said like, hey, I'm a competitor of yours. And I was like, you're not a competitor of mine.
Right.
And they were like, what? What are you talking about? And I'm like, you know, I don't think we're competitors. Then I said, and if it turns out that we are competitors someday, you know, 5 years down the road, it turns out that you and I are the competitors, then wow, we've really screwed up, right? The two of us, right? Like, because the total market was just you and I as competitors, right? Then that would really suck. For me, like, I'm trying to, if I'm really addressing a customer problem, just like you are at Barometrics, then there are going to be endless competitors, and there are going to be software and services and providers and hacks that people are doing. It's like an endless list of things. It's not like a company or a list of companies. It's basically different ways to solve a problem that a person has. And so that's how I think about competitors. I was psyched to hear that this competitor was copying our stuff and offering free, you know, 3 months off to customers. Awesome, that's great. But do I think about them? Never.
Yeah.
At all.
We have basically the same view on it. I think, like, to me, there, especially when you're talking startups, like, there's so much. New
noise.
And everything's new, though. It's like there's so many, not necessarily new problems, but kind of new problems, and like everybody's jumping on board to figure out how to solve them. But it's like in the grand scheme of things, still so absurdly early. Anything that's like, the reality is you and that competitor who may have started trying to solve the same problem in the same year. The fact is, like, as long as you're focused on, like you said, the customer and solving your customer's problems, then like there's a fork in the road that happens, and you go one way and they go the other, and you either end up solving completely different problems, or one of you picked the wrong fork in the road to take and you don't exist anymore. Right. And
I totally agree with you. And like, even if I go back to Performal, and when you asked about it, you know, I mentioned like Omniture we would compete against, but you know, you consider Mixpanel and Kissmetrics in there, and maybe some other companies. And I think like what we were doing at Performal was we were really early kind of second wave of marketing automation, right? First wave being something like Eloqua and a couple other things that existed at the high enterprise side. And we were taking that stuff down to mid-market and SMB. And so like there was Eloqua and there was one or two others, but like if you look now and say like, it was an entire category. It wasn't one or two companies, right? Like if we went down the list of marketing automation companies, even marketing automation companies that are like, actually pretty large in size, the list is so long. You know, I don't know the end of that list, right? And the point being that, no, it was a category that we were trying to go after because we identified the right pain. And there's going to be endless new companies in that era, including stuff like Drip, you know, which is a great product that Rob Walling started. Like, I love that product. That came along, you know, what, 2 years ago? And there's going to be another 10 versions of Drip 3.0 and 5.0 after it because it's a legitimate business problem that they're solving.
Well, I almost think like a lot of entrepreneurs give themselves way too much credit for their ability to solve problems. Like they, you know, you start this product and like to think that you're like fully solving the problem the day that you launch some product is so full of yourself, right? Like what Barometrics is almost 3 years old, and it's like the way that we're, the things that we're doing and even just like features, it's a different product than it was 3 years ago, right? And to think that you know everything about a problem and that you're fully solving it, and that there's not more market to get after you've launched the business is crazy, right? Yeah.
That's totally crazy. That's why, you know, like at this point, I have almost like a Zen view on things. And it's just like, my view is like, I don't know. I don't know. And maybe that's like, I'm mature enough now and like that I can say that where I couldn't say it before. It's like, oh, what do you think about this? And that I have no idea. I don't know. So how are we going to figure it out? I know how we're going to figure it out. And it's going to involve, you know, making lots of mistakes and learning from those and, you know, and learn and talking to customers. We all know how the scientific process works, right, of experimentation. That's how we're going to figure it out. But I don't know. Like, it's something in, you know, on maybe entrepreneurs or maybe in our world, technology, that we're afraid to say that. But, you know, in any other medium, you know, that, you know, that relies on the same process, whether it's actual science, hard science, or like the arts, people are okay with that, the game of iteration and the game of figuring it out and the game of putting in the work in order to do that. And for some reason, we want to be right in version, you know, one.
Yep, yep. And I think like probably a lot of the companies that fail are the ones that refuse to adapt, right? Like, to say like, man, that was the worst idea we have ever had. And
like, you're so right.
Yeah. So
you're so right. And those are the, you know, when I meet with young entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs who's starting a first company, the ones that scare me the most are the ones where you can detect that in them. Yep. That they're so, it's kind of the other side of that. It's great that they have passion for what they're doing, but you can detect in some people like that they're not going to budge. That they're not going to give, right? And no matter what evidence you put in front of their face, they will never give. And you know, maybe that's where the heroes come from. I don't know, but I don't know anyone that's been successful that way.
Yep, yep. Well, cool, David. Well, thanks for taking a few minutes to chat.
Thank you, Josh. Man, it's been a pleasure, dude.
I appreciate it. Is there anything anything that you want to say or push or?
Yeah, no, I don't want to push. You know, okay. I love the stuff that you do. I'm always reading your blog at Barometrics, so I love your voice and love your stuff. And just getting into the podcast game myself. We do a podcast called Seeking Wisdom. Check it out if you're interested at all. But no, nothing to plug. You know, okay. Just want to learn.
All right, right on. Well, good deal. Well, that's all I got on my end.
All right. Take care, man. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, David.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. That does it for our first episode of Founder Chats. Thank you, David, for being a guinea pig here. And you can find David all over the internet. His Twitter handle is dcancel. And you can check out drift.com to see what he's up to. He's also got a fantastic podcast called Seeking Wisdom, which you should check out. If you enjoyed this format, this podcast, a rating on iTunes would go a long way, especially for a new podcast like this. So if you head to iTunes, give it a rating. That would mean a ton. If you have any questions, any feedback, shoot me an email, josh@barometrics.com or on Twitter @Spigford. Thanks for listening.